Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
9/11 attacks. We've heard news stories about terrorism suspects in U.S. custody being sent abroad, sometimes in CIA planes, for harsh questioning by foreign intelligence agents. Well, a report in today's Washington Post sheds new light on these stories. It alleges that since 9/11, the CIA, not the U.S. military, but the CIA, secretly detained and interrogated more than 100 terrorism suspects in a covert prison system around the world that is in part congressionally funded. And virtually nothing is known about who is kept in these detention facilities called black sites or what techniques are used to get information from these suspects. Joining us on the line is Dana Priest, the Washington Post reporter who wrote today's story. Dana, about a year ago, we spoke with you about some form of secret detention involving shipping containers, for instance. What's different about this story?
Well, after a lot of work, we think we have a fuller picture of, as you correctly pointed out, a covert program. In the paper today, we talk about 8 sites, several of which are in Eastern European democracies, and that's a very new finding for us. We had known about a site in Afghanistan where there's virtually no government. We knew about a site in Thailand that had been closed, and one at Gitmo, Guantanamo Bay, that had also been closed. But now we learn that they are in several Eastern European democracies. To me, that's significant, and it was for the paper, because the reason that the CIA chose to do this overseas is that it would be illegal to keep people under these conditions in the United States, where the rule of law prevails and even terrorist suspects have some rights to counsel and hear the evidence against them and this sort of thing. The agency elected to take this overseas in a secret form, and they have done so in countries where, similar to ours, it would be illegal to do this. So we have just put together what we think is the fullest picture, after a lot of work, fullest picture about this whole system.
And by the way, you write that the officials who you spoke with on condition of anonymity also asked you, and you complied, asked you not to name the countries that have these sites because it could cause huge problems for those countries.
Yes, that's correct. Senior administration officials asked us not to name the sites. They cited possible terrorist retaliation against those countries and possible disruption of counterterrorism cooperation with those countries. And after mulling that over for quite some time, the paper decided that that was appropriate.
Well, you write that some of the questions being raised are about the morality, the legality, but also the productivity. I mean, we have heard that many in the CIA, even in the CIA, don't feel that this kind of secret detention even works. But I'm also wondering, what's the end game? What are they thinking they're going to do with these people? Where are they going to go? Are they going to stay there for life?
Right. And that is a debate within the agency. Many people have asked on their own to their higher-ups, you know, what is the end game here? The CIA is not and shouldn't be in the business of being jailers. It's a relatively small agency, and its core mission is espionage. Why are we continuing to keep these people? The answer is, I think, although I don't have the complete answer, that the administration, which is going to ultimately rule on this, just has not made it a priority to figure out, well, what is the end game?
You write that of the 100 or so suspects held in these black sites, about 30 are considered a very high value. 70 others are not, but are being detained for, you know, other reasons. Can you put this story into the context of other recent news about detainees that we've been hearing? Vice President Dick Cheney secretly lobbying for CIA agents to be exempt from any ban on torture that might soon pass in Congress. And also a story in today's New York Times that there's a sharp debate in the Bush administration over whether or not the Defense Department should even adopt language from the Geneva Conventions prohibiting harsh interrogations. Do these two offices, the Vice President's and the Defense Department, do they have these black sites in mind?
No. The Defense Department doesn't. This is now the Vice President. Yes, I think he does. But the main debate around interrogations has revolved around the military's detainees, because we have had a look into that. Congress can investigate that, sometimes publicly.
This is at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib.
Abu Ghraib. The CIA has not ever confirmed the existence of these sites, and they certainly have never talked about it publicly, nor have they talked about it with most members of the Intelligence Oversight Committee. So that's one difference. The second difference is the CIA has what they call enhanced interrogation techniques. They have authority to use those techniques. Unlike the military system, we don't know what those are. And this is where the Vice President's office comes in. He and the CIA are trying to get an exemption for the CIA and for the people they hold in custody in these black sites, but they don't say that it's in these black sites. They want an exemption from Senator John McCain's legislation, which would call on all U.S. personnel who are handling captives here or abroad that they be treated in accordance with an Army field manual on interrogation and in accordance with the UN Convention Against Torture and Inhumane Treatment, which the United States has signed.
Dana Priest, National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post. Dana, have you heard response from Congress about your article?
I've heard response from everyone except Congress, but that's not surprising. They communicate in different ways.
Dana, thank you.
Thank you.
Dana Priest, National Security Correspondent for The Washington Post. Now to Philadelphia, where an increasingly common labor story is also causing a commuter nightmare as 400,000 people who usually ride mass transit are forced to find another way to work. Transit employees are in the third day of a strike, with the fight centered on health benefits. Transit authorities want employees to pay a 5% increase in medical insurance premiums. Well, the twin issues of health care and retirement pensions are at the center of more and more labor disputes, as the American worker has seen both evaporate, what Time magazine calls the downsizing of the American dream. Time's investigation is titled The Great Retirement Ripoff. It's the current cover story, and investigative reporter Jim Steele, who co-authored the article, joins us now on the line. Hi, Jim.
Nice to be with you, Robin.
And let's remind ourselves, this defined pension plan, you call it the gold standard, pretty much guaranteeing a payment to a worker for life after a certain amount of years. How many companies still offer this?
We're roughly down to about less than 30,000 actual plans. I mean, what's amazing about this is that if you just go back to the mid-'80s, you had really 110,000, 115,000 such plans. And in just literally 20 years, this has just evaporated. Back in those days, two out of every five workers in the private sector had those plans. Now we're down to less than one in five.
Why is that?
Part of it is beginning in the mid-'80s, it's an economic thing. Companies began to shift from defined benefit plans, which are more costly to them, to what they call defined contribution plans, largely 401ks, where they can more clearly pinpoint some of their obligations.
And where employees put in money.
And where employees very often put in money. But frankly, the bottom line there is that 401ks, defined contribution plans, simply cost companies less. And that's what's involved here. The defined benefit plans were the gold standard, as you mentioned there, because they guaranteed employees a lifetime of income. This was a certain thing. You knew you would get it. You didn't have to manage your own investments, which you do with a 401k. So all of those things made those the gold standard. And companies, it's just part of the general budget cutting and so forth, have been eliminated.
Well, and you write that Congress, in fact, pushed companies in that direction and wrote many policy decisions that brought us to where we are. We want to hear more about those in just a moment. But you mentioned that companies did this as well because they felt they couldn't afford full pensions. When companies go belly up and enter these bankruptcy proceedings, employees are often at the end of the line, you know, behind other creditors.
Exactly.
And we have an example of that. Former Waltham, Massachusetts-based Polaroid declared bankruptcy in 2001, left many workers without health care and other retirement benefits that they were counting on. Now, just briefly, some of those employees tried to sue to get their pensions, but largely failed.
They did, and in fact, what happened in Polaroid, sadly, is happening all over the country. It's becoming an increasingly common thing. When Polaroid went into bankruptcy, there were a whole range of benefits evaporated right before that or once the procedure happened, severance benefits, health benefits for retirees under 65. One of the most significant things that people at Polaroid had paid into and this was their own money. This wasn't some corporate benefit that the company had provided. Many of them had given up 8% of their salary since the late 80s to fund an employee stock ownership plan on the basis that it would help the company and that would put away a little money for their own retirement.
Well, hold on a second, because, in fact, earlier today we spoke to Dan O'Neill, a Polaroid worker for 31 years. He said he was forced to pay into that plan and that he ultimately lost $90,000 that he had invested in the employee stock ownership plan. And now he says his wife suffered colon cancer. He took another hard hit because he lost his health care, and he pays for his own insurance coverage. Let's listen.
I'll put it right to a fine point. My medical for both my wife and I through Blue Cross Blue Shield was, as of September, $1,263 a month. And that money was coming out of my Social Security, and also I was taken out of my retirement money. I thought I'd be able to sit back and retire just like the top shelf of the company where they took off and had quite a good retirement.
Jim Steele, a couple things there. Complaints that management seemed to do quite fine when companies went belly up, but also that it seems as if these employee pay-in plans, as you pointed out, also aren't always safe.
Well, they're not safe, and in fact, I mean, obviously the workers at Enron, WorldCom, a lot of those other companies, some of the more visible ones, people found those out. But the folks at Polaroid, I think this was the sense, because I talked to a lot of these people. We had a section in our piece on Polaroid. Folks just felt betrayed by this because they'd given their money up, and if they knew that it was not going to be there, obviously they would have put it elsewhere. And I think that's the underlying thing here. Many people believe in their companies. They want to do the right thing. They want to save for their own retirement. Then when they get to that point, the company turns around and says to them, whoops, it's not there after all. You're on your own.
We're talking to Jim Steele. He co-authored the Time magazine cover story on the Great Retirement Ripoff, as they're calling it, the disappearing pensions. And there is a government agency, as we know, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, that's supposed to help out when companies fail, nowhere near what workers might have expected from the companies, because there is a ceiling on how much this government agency will pay, isn't there?
There is, Robin. In fact, it's around $45,000 a year. But even depending on your pension, you may not even get that based on a certain formula they use. At least there is that kind of insurance. But the problem with this thing is with more and more companies dumping their pensions onto PBGC, and now we see the Delphi situation, the auto parts maker, they have some unfunded liabilities. The automakers are there. Many of the airlines have also done this. The question is, now PBGC has an unfunded liability of $450 billion. That's potential pensions that they're going to have to pay. That's a huge financial cloud hanging over that agency. And as time goes on, when more and more companies see that they can basically eliminate their obligations by going to bankruptcy, that number is only going to grow.
So, Jim Steele, it seems as if we're looking at a government and several government agencies that and Congress pushing companies to sort of, allow them to be lenient and not live up to their pension promises. And now it looks as if the government is going to have to bail out a lot of these agencies and a lot of these workers. Jim Steele has co-authored the Time magazine cover story. We'll have much more from Jim when we come back, including what happens now. And if you think you're going to get a pension, well, should you think again? Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Retirement. Time magazine saying it's a retirement that's pretty much a fraud. Seniors who expected to live out their elderly years in relative comfort now finding that corporations can legally renege on promises of pensions. We've been speaking with Time magazine investigative reporter Jim Steele, who recently co-authored a cover story about pensions in America. And Jim, I want to really hit on that. This is legal, what companies are doing. And tell us again, how has legislation helped this happen?
This is an excellent question, and it was one of actually the most amazing things that sort of surprised us about this process. What happens is, if you go into bankruptcy court, employees go to the very end of the line. Banks go to the front of the line. Other investors are up there. So in other words, whatever assets are there, the folks who've loaned the money or somehow or another are financially involved, they get first dibs. But an employee who may have given 10, 20, 30 years of his or her life to that company, may have even invested some of their own funds in its various programs, they stand the possibility of getting basically nothing. Now, you could change that. Congress could change that in a minute by changing this priority in the whole bankruptcy pecking order. But every time this has been raised in Congress, it's been turned down, and instead we had this year, they adopt a bankruptcy law, which is making it much harder for individuals, as you know, to even file for bankruptcy. So rather than dealing with the abuses on the corporate side, they've simply made things harder for people on the human, the individual side.
But don't we understand as well that Congress is also now working on pension bills to force companies to pay what they're supposed to pay?
They are doing this, and obviously if they do some of this, this would be good. But one of the problems they're also dealing with is they're talking about substantially increasing the premium on the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation for those companies that take part in that. And the increase that they're proposing, which is as much as 60% hike, may be counterproductive. You may have a lot of good companies that say, look, I'm just not going to go that right. I'm going to pull out of this. So they run the risk of, rather than increasing the insurance and increasing the security, it may further undermine the pension system.
Well, we also spoke earlier about how the trend now being towards, instead of defined pension plans, contributor pension or contributor plans in which employees pay into the plan. Let's hear from another worker. In Coon City, Minnesota, about 21 Teamsters went on strike at the Rum River Lumber Company after that company decided to switch to a 401k plan, a contributor employee pay-in plan. We spoke to Dave Reed, who's on the picket line there from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. every day.
I drive a forklift and set up all the material on a forklift and set it all up, and then a semi takes it out. I've been on strike now for about 6.5 months. We're on strike because they want to take away our pension. It's not about pay, it's about the pension. I've been in the union for 26 years, and my retirement pay would have been $3,000 a month at 30 years. But because I won't get that 30 years in, it's only $640 a month. And that's the reason why we're on the strike line. You can't work 26 years and just give it up. That's one of the reasons why you're in a union, to have that pension, because you can't trust Social Security to be there. If I don't make a stand, it's going to happen all over the country. And people have to realize that this is what we're working for. We're working for our future, for our retirement. And it's not just my pension. It's my wife's pension. If something happens to me, she loses that money, too. So that's the reason why I'm out there. You know, I work outside. I work in snow and cold, and you know how cold it gets in the wintertime. And I work in the rain in the fall and the spring, and you work it. I work that way because of the pension. I knew that pension would be there. And so I put up with the cold. Even my kids would say, Dad, how can you stand it? Well, it's for your future. And that's the reason you work anyway, is for your future. And now it's not there. It's like I'm 58 years old, and it's not there. And I don't have 20 years to build it up. I just did not figure this would happen. I didn't believe it would happen. I thought I'd retire here. I thought I'd do my time and say goodbye. And they decided that they no longer wanted me there.
And that's Dave Reed, formerly from the Rum River Lumber Company, is now on strike. Probably won't get his job back because they've hired workers to take his place. And Jim Steele, we called Rum River, but didn't get a call back. But they've said they need to switch to 401k plans and drop the pension plans because they need to stay afloat. I just want to ask you to comment on that, but also on Dave Reed's comment that he's doing this for other people as well. And it raises the question, why isn't there more outcry over this? Do you think people who don't work for companies and aren't expecting pensions, I don't know, maybe you're a little jealous about the people trying to hold on to theirs? I mean, why isn't there more outcry?
Well, I think there is a lot of anxiousness in the country. I mean, it's just not organized in a way that you can always hear it. I mean, we've heard, since we did our pension piece, we've heard from just many, many people. And one of the women we wrote about got inundated with calls from her community, people saying, thank heaven you spoke up. Somebody needed to do this. There are a lot of older people in this situation. So I think there's anxiety on it. The problem is there's no organized effort in this regard. And unions, I think, have clearly felt between a rock and a hard place on this, because the bankruptcy courts can basically eliminate these benefits. There's very little recourse a union has. So everything has been shifting against people in that regard. But I wouldn't underestimate for one moment the anxiousness, the concern, the desire to do something. And what we found over and over again are people just like Dave there who felt betrayed. They've given their time, they put in their effort, they worked hard, and then at the end of that journey, where some of their money has been set aside for them, they find out it's not there.
Well, Jim Steele, in the minute we have, what should people do?
I guess the most practical thing, and this isn't the most uplifting kind of news, but frankly, I think the way things are happening now, everybody simply has to approach their life not counting on anything. I mean, if you have a pension, maybe it'll be there, maybe it won't. But you really have to take care of yourself in this world. You have to do as much as you can to put things aside for yourself.
Go back to the old-fashioned savings account.
Because, you know, maybe it'll be there, maybe it won't. Maybe you'll be lucky enough to be with a company that believes in doing the right thing. But probably the smartest thing to do is to pretend it won't be there.
Jim Steele, investigative reporter for Time Magazine. Their cover story is called The Great Retirement Ripoff. It's a disturbing reading, but Jim, thank you for it.
Nice to be with you, Robin.
And stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston. Scooter Libby is scheduled to be arraigned tomorrow, and the White House has named two longtime aides to Dick Cheney to replace Libby in the vice president's office. David Addington is the vice president's new chief of staff. He had served as the vice president's chief counsel. And John Hanna is now Mr. Cheney's assistant for national security. Hanna had been principal deputy assistant for national security affairs. So, who are these two men? Doug Gell covers national security for the New York Times. Today he described David Addington as a master of bureaucratic combat. Doug, what did you mean by that?
I mean that David Addington has spent nearly his entire career in government, and he's learned where power lies and how to use it to his advantage. People say that he's virtually a one-man band at the vice president's office has more than measured up to his rivals at the State Department, the Pentagon, and the Justice Department.
How long have Mr. Addington and Dick Cheney worked together?
They've worked together for nearly 20 years. They came to know each other when David Addington, as a young lawyer, was working on the staff of the House Intelligence Committee when Mr. Cheney was in Congress from Wyoming.
We want to ask you about the role that David Addington played in the build-up to the war in Iraq and directly afterwards. There are reports in the National Journal that he was key to the White House decision to not turn over important documents that may have raised questions about pre-war intelligence. What's known about that?
What's known is that Mr. Addington, as Dick Cheney's lawyer, told the Senate Intelligence Committee, much as he's told just about every committee on Congress, that questions involving internal White House deliberations were none of Congress's business. He rebuffed efforts by the Senate committee to learn more about the role that Mr. Cheney's office played in drafting speeches in the run-up to war. But in some ways, this isn't unusual for Mr. Addington. More than anything else, really, in his career, he's argued that the president has extensive powers, and in virtually all cases, they override those of Congress.
Well, Doug, you also write that David Addington was one of the most important architects of the administration's legal structure for the detention and interrogation of terror suspects. What specifically did he advocate for? How was he involved?
Mr. Addington, beginning just 2 months after the attacks of September 11th, was involved in drafting the legal opinions and memorandum that set out the rules that allowed the United States to detain terrorism suspects outside the Geneva Convention, to treat them as prisoners of war without legal recourse, and to argue that international conventions prohibiting torture had a very limited effect on what the U.S. Could do in its interrogations of these suspects.
This is the 2002 Justice Department paper that was later discounted repudiated by the White House, as you write.
Well, it's that document as well as some other documents leading up to it. In no case did Mr. Addington's name appear on these documents. That's the way he tends to operate, very much in the shadows. But people involved in this decision say that really more than Alberto Gonzalez, the White House counsel, in some ways just as much as Justice Department lawyers at the Office of Legal Counsel. Addington was the architect of these arguments.
Yeah. Well, we're now seeing reports that Vice President Dick Cheney has been trying to get the CIA exempt from any torture bans. And as we reported earlier in the show, there are reports today of a secret CIA detention system. Do we know if David Addington played any role in any of that?
We certainly know about the former. Mr. Addington with Mr. Cheney has been involved in a debate with Congress to argue that it would be foolhardy to limit the CIA's latitude in interrogation of torture suspects. They argue, what would you do if you got another Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and believed an attack was on the way? Would you really want your powers limited to just questioning these people? On the question of what Mr. Addington's role was in the thinking about the CIA detention centers, we don't really know, but one can presume based on his record and the fact that he was very much part of administration councils on these issues, that he certainly was involved in the discussions that led to the setting up of these centers.
Well, the second position that Scooter Libby held, that of Assistant for National Security, is now being filled by John Hanna. We want to quickly say no, not the football player, as some have thought. His ties to the vice president don't seem as tight. What are they, and what is his reputation?
Mr. Hanna, like Mr. Addington, maintains a very low profile in Washington. He doesn't grant interviews. He's rarely seen, but he's wielded a lot of power, particularly in thinking on Iraq.
There are reports that John Hanna was the contact for Ahmad Shalabi, the Iraqi exile who was said to have been spreading the now discredited intelligence through the White House. And that in a lesser role than he has now been appointed to, he fought with the CIA over intelligence about weapons of mass destruction.
That's right. Mr. Hanna was one of the liaisons to Ahmad Shalabi. He was the liaison for the vice president's office. One shouldn't exaggerate that role and argue that he was Shalabi's gatekeeper to the administration. I don't believe that's true. His dealings with the CIA in the debate over pre-war intelligence were important, but not as extensive as those of Mr. Libby, who really was the point man in confronting the CIA, particularly in the argument over whether the ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda were significant and extensive, as Mr. Cheney argued publicly, or were essentially incidental and insignificant, as the CIA argued.
Well, Doug Gell, now, as we know, Democrats have pushed for Republicans and Democrats to investigate the investigation into the intelligence leading to the war. Do you think that either of these names, Addington or Hanna, will come up in that investigation?
That's a very good question. What's still unclear in the debate on Capitol Hill is how deeply any investigation into pre-war intelligence will go. But any comprehensive look at the role that figures within the administration, at the Pentagon and the Vice President's office, as well as the National Security Council, played in reviewing intelligence and producing documents, would have to touch on the role that Mr. Addington and Mr. Hanna, as well as Mr. Libby, played, and particularly in the drafting of the speech that Colin Powell ultimately gave to the Security Council in February 2003, laying out the administration's rationale for war. The rough draft of that speech was written primarily by Scooter Libby, and it was an even more hawkish case for war than Powell ultimately presented.
Doug Gell, he covers national security for the New York Times. Doug, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on this story or anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. And please tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. And still to come, Rod Stewart. He once topped the charts with Hot Legs. Now he's singing about making whoopee. We'll hear about his Great American Songbook. New Orleans is a music town, so when the floodwaters from Hurricane Katrina receded, thousands of ruined pianos surfaced, and the cost of replacing and repairing them will either be overwhelming or a financial boon for the American piano industry. Alexander Soule reports for the Boston Business Journal, and Alex, you wrote that one American piano company in particular may benefit from post-Hurricane Katrina piano sales.
Steinway Musical Instruments, which is the parent company of Steinway & Sons. Steinway Musical Instruments is based in Waltham, Massachusetts, but the soul of the business is down on Long Island, New York, where they've been in business for about 150 years now.
Now, Steinway isn't speaking about how many piano orders it might be getting from New Orleans, but why is this important to you as a business reporter that this company might actually get this boost?
It brings actually interesting questions to light of how people run their companies. Steinway is a very much union shop on Long Island, and union contracts call for them to produce all concert-style grand pianos in the United States.
And we should say Steinway has another line of pianos that they can outsource, but we're talking about the Steinway Concert Grand. It has to be made here in the U.S., and it's sort of the creme de la creme.
It is. They go for as high as $93,000 for a standard version. And if you look at the numbers coming out of Louisiana, Steinway would not talk, but one of their independent dealers down there would. He's looked at about 270 Steinways since the floodwaters receded, which if you do the math on that, you're talking well over $3 million. And really, he said they're just getting into it. Another refurbisher down there, Lance Lafargue, he was down there till 9:30 at night the other day, just spending all day looking at pianos.
And that's hundreds of pianos. We're going to talk, by the way, to Mr. Lafargue in just a moment. But do you think Steinway is going to be able to come up with that many pianos?
And that's the interesting management question. On average, it takes each of their 500 union members in New York about 3 months to produce a piano. So what we don't know is the inventory that Steinway has on hand. It'll be interesting to see how that all works out.
Alexander Soule, Boston Business Journal, thanks so much for bringing this to our attention.
Thanks, Ron.
And we turn now to Lance Lafargue, as we said, a piano refurbisher and the owner of Lafargue Pianos, on the line from Louisiana. Lance, this must be a terrible sight for someone who I assume loves pianos.
I can tell you in words, but unless you hear, unless you see it, it's probably a piano on every block. And, of course, New Orleans is a huge music place, and before World War II, everybody had a piano in their house.
Right. We're understanding some, you know, kind of famous pianos as well. Fats Domino found his overturned. What are some of the other noted pianos have you come across or heard about?
Well, I just looked at Harry Connick Jr.'s piano that he learned on. Not a fancy piano, but other than the sentimental value attached, it's really not worth restoring.
Right. How many Steinways have you seen?
Probably two to three dozen.
What else are people telling you? I mean, you mentioned Harry Connick's childhood piano. What personal stories are people telling you about their pianos? It's fascinating.
This one lady I'm thinking of called me, and she said, I need you to do an estimate. You know, I had 6 feet of wall, and I said, ma'am, your piano is not repairable. And we talked for like 5 minutes or so. Finally, she starts crying, and she said, I'm keeping the piano. This is my grandmother's piano. The last guy I just saw, I mean, he's talking about it like it's a person. I've had a great relationship with this piano. This has been a wonderful piano. Mm. And if I can at all save this thing, I definitely want to do it.
Well, Lance Lafargue, tell us, as a piano refurbisher, how far does the water have to go before it's irretrievable?
Every piano is different. Generally, if in an upright you get more than an inch or two, you're going to start to have some problems. Mm. But if a grand gets water up into the key bed, that's really serious. If it gets up into the pin block and the soundboard, you're pretty much sunk because now that's the heart of the piano. And by the way, a Steinway B in 8 foot of water, it floats up and then it turns over. So they're all upside down.
Mm. How long, if you do start refurbishing, how long do you think it'll take?
To get everybody rebuilt?
Yeah, if you do some rebuilding.
Years, because, I mean, especially when you're dealing with Steinways, it's a lot of craftsmanship, and it's got to be, if it's going to be Steinway again, it's got to be done right. It's huge.
Lance Lafargue, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Sure.
Lance Lafargue is a piano refurbisher in New Orleans. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
late September and I really should be back at school.
There was 1971's Maggie May. Then Do You Think I'm Sexy? Hot Legs. Everyone knows Rod Stewart is a rocker, albeit a fancy suit-clad one. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1994, and Spin magazine columnist Chuck Klosterman recently called him the single greatest male singing voice of the rock era. Well, nowadays, Rod Stewart is lending that voice to another era.
Here I go again. I'm hearing trumpets blow again. I'll aglow again, taking a chance on love.
This switch to standards has produced a 4-CD series called The Great American Songbook. Stardust Volume 3 of the series won Stewart a Grammy Award last year, and the 4th CD, Thanks for the Memory, is now number 2 on Billboard's list of top-selling pop albums. And now, that voice that some are calling the greatest in rock joins us on the line. Welcome, Rod Stewart.
Hi there. I paid that guy to say that, by the way.
and then many others as well. Does it feel like a little bit of a rebirth?
Well, it certainly does, yeah. I mean, because, as you said, they've done so amazingly well. I think 13 or 14 million so far. So at my stage of the game, it was more than welcome.
And from what I understand, things that you've said about the first three, this series has been in you, this music has been in you for a long time. This isn't just a rocker saying, oh, I've reached a certain age and I have to find a new passion. You've had passion for these standards.
Yeah. Well, I grew up with most of them. And I've always loved the likes of Billie Holiday and Ella Fitzgerald and Louis Armstrong. And when I was with the Faces, even Ronnie Wood could probably bear me out here. I used to warm up singing most of these standards before I went out and did Hot Legs and Stay With Me, etc.
I'm looking at some of the songs on this CD. I've Got a Crush on You, I Wish You Love, Making Whoopee. How do you pick the songs? And now, especially now that you're into your fourth CD, some might think these are the less favorite.
Mm. Well, I wouldn't agree with that. I think they're all as powerful as each other. We try and find a perfect blend of song, but I mean, I've already got another 20 songs I could record for a songbook number 5 if I wanted to. And since the albums have been very successful, every Tom, Dick and Harry wants to help and say, why don't you sing this one? I get notes in restaurants. How about doing this one and that one? So,
well, what should we listen to as we proceed here? What would you like us to hear?
Let's hear the first track. It's one of my favorites.
I've Got a Crush on You. It's a duet with Diana Ross.
I've got a crush on you, sweetie pie, all the day and night time. Hear me sigh, I never had the least notion that I could fall with so much emotion. Ooh, could you cool? Could you care? We could share. The world will pardon my mush, 'cause I have got a crush, my baby, on you.
Rod Stewart, what do you like about that song?
I think Diana Ross's performance is absolutely spot on, and mine's pretty good as well.
Well, I didn't mean your recording of it. I meant the song itself. What grabs you about it?
The melody.
Yeah. Is it all? It's all melody, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what the standards were about. You've said these songs are not easy to sing by a long chalk. I have two questions. First of all, what's a long chalk?
Christ, I've got no idea. It's just an old British expression. I've got no idea. That's one of those wonderful British expressions that no one knows where it came from. And actually, we know what it means, but we don't know the origin of it.
And why are the songs, harder to sing?
There's many nuances in these songs that one forgets sometimes when you think you know the song, and you go to record it. And I've been tripped up many times like this, that you think you know the song and you really don't, because there's so many different, hidden melodies that you have to explore.
Well, let's listen to some more. I'm looking at the song list again, Let's Fall in Love from 1933. And You Send Me from Sam Cooke, 1957.
Darling, you send me. I know that you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do.
The reason we put You Send Me In is almost like an experiment, because we want to, you know, for the next album, maybe go into the Great American Soul Book. So we just stuck this one in to see what sort of reaction we get.
Oh.
And it was very difficult for me to do You Send Me, because I considered it, you know, being a lifelong Sam Cooke fan, hallowed ground. But when Steve Terrell suggested making it into a duet, I thought, well, that's a pretty good idea. There's a lot of people who've never heard of that song. My kids had never heard of it.
Oh, isn't that... What do your kids say about it? Do they think this is something brand new?
Yeah, yeah, I had to tell them. You know, I said, no, this was Sam Cooke's first hit, you know.
There's another song on this fourth release, Thanks for the Memory. That is, you know, such an iconic song. Bob Hope's signature song for so many years.
Yeah, I never knew that.
You did it?
No. You know, living in Britain and growing up in Britain, I didn't realize it was Bob Hope's signature tune until this song was actually brought to me. I knew the song, but I didn't know it belonged to Bob Hope. This song was brought to me by my wonderfully gay manager. And he said this is one of his favorites. He wanted me to record it. I had no idea that it was Bob Hope's signature tune.
Really?
Yeah.
So you weren't singing it and thinking of... Americans touring and during the wars. You weren't thinking of any of those things.
No, I was totally... I knew Bob Hope had sung it, but it was... I didn't know it was, you know, to Bob Hope what Maggie May is to me and, you know, Honky Tonk Woman is to the Rolling Stones. That's nicely put, wasn't it?
Mm, it was.
You know,
it
it's their just one signature song. I never knew that.
And no harm does or thanks for the memory of summers at the shore. Nights in Singapore, you may have been a headache, but you never were a bore. I thank you so much.
What were you thinking about when you were singing it?
It's just a gorgeous set of lyrics. I don't know who the songwriter is off the top of my head. Maybe you've got the information there, but it's just, you know, it conjures up all sorts of images, and I love songs like that.
Well, Rod Stewart talking about the new CD release, the fourth in his series of standards, The Great American Songbook. And next we have, it sounds like we have to look forward to The Great American Soul Book.
Yeah, well, don't discount songbook number 5 a couple of years down the line, because I do love these songs so much and it'll be very difficult to keep away from them.
Rod Stewart, thanks so much.
My pleasure, darling.
I thank you.
And by the way, it is Thanks for the Memory, not Thanks for the Memories. I thought that too. And the words and music were written by Leo Robin and Ralph Ringer. Rod Stewart's Thanks for the Memory, The Great American Songbook, Volume 4, is in stores now.
No doubt we did. Of course we did. So thanks.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Darling, how are you? And how are the little dreams that never did come true? Awfully glad I met you. Cheerio and toodaloo. And thank you so much.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and the